Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Jeremiah 25 is rather a long chapter. If you have looked through it, it goes verses 38. It's a very interesting chapter in many respects, and it exemplifies what I've been mentioning to you about the displacement chronologically of the book of Jeremiah. Chapter 25 is in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, and if you'll notice up there in chapter 24, it's to Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim. So obviously 24 goes after 25, but the whole book of Jeremiah is like that. It tends to jump around here and there into one king's reign, into another king's reign. Jeremiah spanned many years in several kings. And it's unusual to have such a specific reference as far as date. It mentions two dates here, really more than that in this chapter. It mentions the fourth year of Jehoiakim. It mentions the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, and it mentions that he preached 23 years in verse 3. Many folks believe that 25 is a summary chapter that concluded the first scroll that Jeremiah wrote that was read before the king that he burned, and Baruch had to write another one. And that's quite possible. This is a summary chapter like that. Now, the date we're talking about is, and you might want to write this in your Bibles, it'll help along to have some specific date, 605 B.C. Date is 605 B.C., a lot of things happened in this year. This is the year that Nebuchadnezzar's father died and he returned home to become king of Babylon. This is the year, the Battle of Carchemish, where Babylon defeated the Egyptian army and became the sole empire of the Fertile Crescent. This is the year that Jeremiah dictated his book to Baruch. We find that in chapter 36, verse 1. We even find the Battle of Carchemish mentioned in the Bible in chapter 46, verse 2 and following. And a very important year. Now, many have found a discrepancy between the dating of Jeremiah 25, 1 and the book of Daniel, chapter 1, verse 1. If you look at the book of Daniel quickly, it may take you longer to find it. Some of those little prophets are hard to get out of there. Daniel is right after Ezekiel. Notice where it mentions in Daniel 1:1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. Now, right over here, it's talking about in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, which was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what's the discrepancy? Well, many folks have make light of these kinds of things. Often people criticize people who love and accept the Bible uncritically sometimes. And many times we have to say we don't know what the problem is, but we hope that later discoveries will tell us. Now, I don't think that's a cop-out. That answer finally prevailed in this case. We have learned since, and not many years ago, of two chronologies that were concurrent and coexistent at the same time in the Fertile Crescent, archaeologically verifiable. In Palestine, a king's reign was counted from the year of his ascension. In Babylon, the king's reign was counted from the second year because the ascension year was mentioned as a separate entity. Now, when that archaeological evidence falls into place, this does nothing more than verify the historicity of the Bible. Where was Daniel when he wrote his book? Yeah, of course, I'm assuming you believe that Daniel wrote it, not some Maccabean dude down in 165 B.C. He was in Babylon. And, of course, he followed the Babylonian chronology. Where was Jeremiah? He was in Palestine, and of course he followed the chronology of his day in that area. And so here we have real proof, not only the historicity of the book of Daniel, but the historicity of the book of Jeremiah, that we could not answer many years ago. And so I think sometimes we have to say we don't know answers to some questions, but we feel like if we wait, the questions will work themselves out. So that I think that helps very much. Now, if you continue through this, I'm going to be skipping some. That's too much for me to read tonight. You'll notice in verse 3 it says, in the 13th year of Josiah, son of Amon. Boy, Jeremiah is really putting some dates on this thing, isn't he? He's locking this booger down in history. Now, he hadn't done that before. He wants you to know the date and what's happening and how history is coalescing into the purpose of God. And he mentions he started his preaching in the 13th year of Josiah. And it's been 23 years now since the word of the Lord came to me. Now, some, we don't know exactly how to date this thing. Some think, does that mean the word of the Lord that came to him and called him from his mother's womb? Well, I really don't think God spoke to Jeremiah in the womb. I think he spoke to him when he was older and told him that he was with him that long. I get kind of tickled at some of the arguments we make about children. You know, the Bible doesn't talk a whole lot about children. And I remember especially a Presbyterian commentator that I like so much, and I think it's Burkhoff, and I think also Martin Luther and Calvin picked up on this. They said, if John the Baptist can kick in his mother's womb at the presence of Jesus, why can't he be baptized as soon as he arrives? That's a far-fetched example for trying to get infant baptism, isn't it? So I don't think this is talking about when Jeremiah was prenatal, God called him. I think it's saying when he recognized, older and understood. Now, he was a young man when God called him. 13, 14, right in there. So I think he's been preaching 23 years since that call, about 14 or 15. I don't know about you, but usually we like to see some kind of response from our labors. Like to see some success or some fruition or some making a difference or something. Boy, the faithfulness of Jeremiah, 23 years faithfully proclaiming a message that was hard for him to preach. And no converts. The only response Jeremiah had, his own family rejected him, his own town tried to kill him, and the people in Jerusalem kicked him out of the temple numerous times, threw him in cisterns, put him in chains, and Jeremiah kept on preaching 23 years. Matter of fact, he goes long past this. Reminds me of Noah when it says Noah preached 120 years without one convert. Well, Jeremiah didn't preach that long, but he had a long, seemingly unresponded to ministry. Take heart. By the way, I think it says also that Jeremiah knew who he was. It says here, the word of the Lord came to me and I had spoken to you again and again, but you would not listen. There's no doubt in Jeremiah's mind who and what he was. He was a prophet called by God. And that kind of vision and call sustained him through days when no one would listen. Jeremiah knew who and what he was, and it sustained him. Now, his message, of course, verse 4 says, nothing new about that. God sent the prophets, and you didn't listen to them either. And verse 5, his message comes back with two imperatives. Turn, and now mine has dwell. I probably would like the word live better. And here is Jeremiah confronting God's people with the option to respond. You see, I think when we don't allow for the balance of God calling but man responding, we get into all kinds of difficulties. Here Jeremiah is calling the nation of Israel, God's chosen people, and he's calling them for a response and an action and a commitment and a turn. And he's saying quite frankly, if you will, God will save your land. If you won't, you won't believe how bad it's going to be. Now, they had the option. It's the same kind of theology in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses says, through Joshua, of course, by then, Moses is dead, I set before you life, I set before you death. Choose you this day which path you will follow. Well, that's the kind of decision that man's had to make from the very beginning, and that's the kind of decision man has to make in the light of Jesus Christ today. Choose you. Now, I'm not saying God doesn't come first, and God didn't prepare the heart, and God doesn't always come in grace, I think. But I do think man must respond. And here it clearly is. Two imperatives. Now, notice the condition here. On the land which the Lord has given you and your forefathers forever and ever. That's double olam. Now, olam is an unusual Hebrew word. It can mean a long time. It can mean eternity. It depends on the context. If I was looking at this in the context, does it fit that God gave the promised land to the descendants of Abraham for eternity? Now, theologically, yes. But experientially, what? No. the exile is about to occur, and all the God's people be out for at least 70 years here. They've been out in our lifetime a long time, and back since 1947. So I think what we have to say is, here is a good balance. If they would, God would. God wanted to give them the land forever. But they wouldn't. And so there are periods of them being in and out of the land dependent on their response to the covenant obligations. Okay? He mentions in verse 6 and 7, they were continued to make him angry. Now, this is an anthropomorphism. I don't think God stomps around heaven and kicks things over and, you know. It is speaking about God as if he was a man. Now, God doesn't have temper tantrums, but God does have a settled opposition to man systematically destroying the creation that he made. God has a settled disposition against man doing his own thing. And we have to realize that. I wouldn't say it would be anger as we know anger, but it would be a committed response to sin. Okay? Now, when it mentions a little further down in verse 9, something very strange, it caused great problems for people. And look at this. Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north. Talking about Babylon, apparently, declares the Lord. And I will send to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant. Oh. Woo! Was Nebuchadnezzar a believer? Well, the book of Daniel says that Nebuchadnezzar did recognize the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. But it didn't mean he ceased to recognize Marduk. At best, Nebuchadnezzar was a polytheist, at best. This is not saying something about Nebuchadnezzar's personal relationship of faith to Yahweh. This is the title that's used of Moses almost, Yahweh, servant of Yahweh. Here, the word Yahweh is not there. But it means, does it mean that Nebuchadnezzar is a committed follower of the God of Israel? No. What it does mean is that he is a tool in God's hand. Now, this word calling him a servant is used in chapter 27, verse 6, chapter 43, verse 10. And one even more startling than this is in Isaiah chapter 44, verse 28 through Isaiah 45, 1, where Cyrus is called, God calls Cyrus, my shepherd, my anointed. Now, the word anointed is the word Messiah. Cyrus, I do not believe, was a believer. At best, I think Cyrus was a polytheist. Now, people say, let the Jews go home. Yes, he did. He gave them money to rebuild a temple. Yes, he did. He also did that to every other captured people. It was his political decision to reverse the policy of the Assyrians and the Babylonians to try to engender a faithful, passive population back in their own home, worshiping their own gods. But to call Cyrus the Messiah is a strong, strong term. I think it means God is using them for his purposes, even though they may not realize it. And I have a question for you in a minute about that. Notice where it continues, and I will bring them against the land and its inhabitants and against the nations all around, and I will utterly destroy them and make them a horror, a hissing, and an everlasting destruction. Now, in your Bible, when it says, I will utterly destroy them, do you see that in the latter part of verse 9? Look in the margin of your Bible. Do you have another translation there? Or what do y'all have in your translation? Tim, give me a couple of words. What do y'all have? No, when it says, I will utterly destroy them and make them a horror and a hissing, what does yours have? I will utterly... Does all of them have destroy? Under the ban, okay? Bernard, what yours has? Cause to perish. This is that special, special term that we came across in Joshua. It's known as the harem. Yes, it is a form of harem. Harem was a group of women dedicated to one man. All right? Well, this is dedicated to God. It's called the harem. It's called under the ban. The New Testament is known as the korban. It means that something was dedicated to God in such a way that it was inappropriate for man's use anymore. Therefore, the only way to assure its sacredness was to totally destroy it. It is a term of holy war. God, the nation of Israel, did this to the Canaanite populations. Nothing lived. Jericho was like this. So what it's talking about is everything that breathes dies. And then what's left is burnt and knocked down. Total destruction. When it says, and an everlasting desolation, here again, a different word for everlasting, but obviously it's not everlasting, is it? No, they're going to rebuild it in 70 years, less than that, really. So it's a, you have to take these terms in the context they're used and not read your preconceived Western-oriented definitions into them. Or, boy, you'll have tremendous problems. Now, notice verse 10. I like this. It's a, talking about the joys of social life. It's going to say, it's going to put it in a negative sense, but listen to this. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of joy, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride. Now, that's been a common thing. Jeremiah's used those phrases several times in the book, but he adds two unique phrases here. They only adds here. And it says, the sound of the millstones and the light of the lamp. Now, the Babylonian Talmud says they were referring to, and I don't know where they get some of this, but they're Jews, and this is their scripture. Maybe they have an inside track. The grinding of the millstone was grinding of medicine to apply to the little boys who had been circumcised. And that the lighting of the lamp is referring to the wedding feast. And so, i.e., what it means is, no more marriages, no more births. Well, I can see that. There's another possibility. Remember when we went through the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, verses 3 through 6? Remember all those funny things about a house? We talked about the grinders quit grinding. And in that context, remember what it meant? It meant older people lose their molars. Remember all those descriptions of old age there? The lamp went out, meaning their eyes got dim. So it may be an allusion to Ecclesiastes, and the reference would be to death. I don't know which it is, but I thought both were interesting. Now, in verse 11, another specific number is mentioned. And the whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. I must admit to you, I think we are so Western-oriented that it's hard for us to read an ancient text. You know, we live with a... Every one of us almost has a calendar watch that has the name, the date, the year, the time, the seconds, a stopwatch, a timer. You know, that's our society in a capsule. We run around. We're so governed by time and half hours and minutes and be here then and be here. And those of you who've traveled to other countries know that's not anywhere but here. You know, they just don't follow this little devil. We follow this as if it was a god almost, don't we? Now, to put that kind of a time element on an Oriental culture thousands of years ago, I think is ridiculous. Now, what does it mean 70 years? Does that mean it's exactly 365 days, 24 hours for every day, and exactly 70 of those to the minute? No. Of course not, it doesn't mean that. It seems to be like the number 40, which many times is a long period of indefinite time. Now, 70, many people have tried to take this thing literally. But the hard thing is to find the place it begins and the place it ends. Now, the closest we can come to it would be something like... the destruction of the temple, 586. The rebuilding of the temple, 516. Now that's about as close to 70 as we can get. How long were the children of Israel in Babylon? When did they come back? Very important date. I've told you a million times. Remember the date? The Edict of Cyrus, right? 538, Edict of Cyrus, let them come home. They were taken, some in 605, that's when Daniel went, 605, first deportation. Some went a little later, and the last group went in 586. Well, if they came home in 538, none of that exactly equals 70 years. So I think it is a round number. I don't think it's a specific number, and I don't know how much closer to get that. 586 to 538 is 48 years, I believe. And so that's not 70, not close to it. The temple is probably the closest, but I don't know. This number is used other times. It's used in Zechariah 1:12 and 7:5. And in Zechariah, it seems to imply the destruction of the temple, to the rebuilding of the temple. And that's 66 years. That's close, right? I don't know. In verse 12, a new context starts, if you would. And I think it's very interesting. Notice what it says. But it will be, when 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity in the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it an everlasting desolation. Same word used in verse 12 for Babylon is used up there in verse 9 for the land of promise, Judah. Now, I've asked a discussion question. I want you to think about it and talk with me a minute. If God sent Babylon to punish Judah, why does He punish Babylon later on for doing it? If He sent them to do it and they did it, why does He punish them for doing it after they did it? Anybody want to answer that question? I think it's obvious, but I don't think you need to think a minute. Why would He do that? That is a perfect example of the way that God works in men's lives. This whole fight about did God harden Pharaoh's heart or Pharaoh harden his own heart? Yes. Yes, he said that happened. You say, well, did God do it or did Pharaoh do it? Yes, that, yes, yes. Did God send Babylon or did Babylon want to come? Yes, yes. God used the natural tendencies of those men to accomplish His purpose. But in the end, those men are responsible for their actions. Did God choose Judas because He knew he would betray Him? Yes. Did Judas have the free will to betray Him? Yes. Is Judas responsible? Yes. Everybody is responsible for their actions. Do you know what we do if we don't believe that? We get into the Flip Wilson theology. Remember Geraldine? The devil made me do it. No, we're not going to stand before God and say the devil made me do it. My culture made me do it. My parents made me do it. My church made me do it. You know, my society forced me into it. No, you little turkey. You're going to stand before God and you're on two feet. We are responsible for our actions even though we're tempted by the evil one, even though we're used in the purposes of God, even though our culture and all of that is conditions us. Ultimately, we are still responsible for our actions. So is it fair that God used Babylon and punished Babylon? Certainly. Just like God used Pharaoh and punished Pharaoh and used Judas and punished Judas. Yes. Now, you want to talk about that? You going to buy that? Y'all are easy tonight. Okay. Verse 13 mentions all of this is written in the book. I get tickled when people say, now, we just don't know in this chapter how much is Jeremiah and how much is an editor. And it's been edited by several people. It always tickles me that those folks do that. It's like they knew something we didn't know. And all they got before them, same book we got before us. Now, I want to admit to you, I think that the book of Jeremiah has gone through some additions. It's the Septuagint translation of chapter 25 is very markedly different than this. But I think we have the essence of Jeremiah. I think we have some minor additions and reconstructions of later hands, but it mentioned several times through here Jeremiah wrote a book. Why do we have to find something different in that? I mean, why do we have to think the different, the radical, the extreme, and instead of just accepting that there is some written material that Jeremiah wrote down through Baruch? Now, we may have it mixed around some. Obviously, we do. But I see Jeremiah's hand all the way through here. Now, after that, verse 13, right before it says all this is written, the Septuagint places chapters 46 through 51. Man, the whole section on the judgment of the nations right here. Modified form, but right here. And then it continues in verse 14, and many nations and great kings shall make slaves of them. Now, who do you think that's talking about? Who's going to make slaves of the Babylonians? What's the next major world empire? No. Medes and Persians. Cyrus and his, yes. So this is referring to the Medes and Persians. verse 15. Thus saith the Lord of Israel, says to me, take up this cup of wine of wrath from my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send to drink it, and they shall drink and stagger and go mad because the sword that I shall bring among them. And I took the cup from the Lord's hand and made all the nations drink to whom the Lord sent me. I won't stop there. The metaphor of a cup of wine, or a cup really, is used quite often in the Old Testament to describe God's purpose for man, man's destiny, man's life. Let me give you a few. There's a bunch of them. I think I've written most of them down there for you. Psalms 63, especially Psalm 75:8, Isaiah 51:17, Ezekiel 23:31-34. And then I've added Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, verse 36. That's exactly what Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. Father, remove this, what? Cup. Now, why would God use a cup of wine as a symbol of judgment? Okay, but why judgment, you think? I mean, the word's used, it causes a cup of blessing many times. Notice the next verse. You shall drink and stagger and go mad. That's a reference to what? Intoxication. The Old Testament is absolutely vehement in its rejection of intoxication. Drunkenness to the Old Testament is the height of foolishness and ridiculousness and danger. The idea here of someone drinking till they stagger and go mad is a biblical picture of nations that are ripe for judgment and vulnerable. Now, I'm just saying the extreme is what's used as a symbol. That's used all the way through here. Now, in verse 19 following, by the way, all these nations are mentioned. In chapter 1, verse 5, God says, Jeremiah, I've called you to be a prophet to the nations. Now, I don't know if Jeremiah went to each one of these nations and preached to their king. He'd probably got killed, you know. They wouldn't have let a Jewish preacher come preach in Egypt and Babylon. Whether it's a vision or symbol, I don't know. But anyway, all the nations are covered here. And I'm going to give you just a brief bit and dash through here. Verse 19, it talks about Egypt. You might want to see chapter 46 where that's explicated. That's where it mentions the defeat at Carmish. In verse 20, it mentions all the kings of the land of Uz. It's not Oz, it's Uz. That's Job's homeland, Job 1:1. That's where Job was born. That's where Job lived. All the kings of the land of the Philistines. Those are the five major cities of the Philistines. These were the only uncircumcised people we know of. They were close to the promised land. That's when they kept calling the uncircumcised. Ashdod, Gaza, Ekron, and Gath are major cities, as well as Ashdod. Edom and Moab and the sons of Ammon. Now, Edom are the descendants of Esau, and all of these are mentioned in chapter 48:1-49:22. Then the kings of Tyre and the kings of Sidon. Those are what? What nation is that? Tyre and Sidon. Phoenicians. Not Philistines, Phoenicians, the seafarers of the day, okay? The kings of the coastlands, which are beyond the sea. And then in verse 23, it has the Dedan, I guess. That's the tribe of merchants from Abraham and Keturah. And then it has Timah. Those are the Arab tribes that live in the desert of Syria. It has the Buzz, the tribe from Nahor, Abraham's brother. And then it sticks something in there that just seems totally out of place. That'd be like me saying, all the people of East Texas, especially those who have burr haircuts. That's what it says. Do yours have something like, and all who cut the corners of their hair? Do you see in your Bible how it's in italics? It's slanted. What does that mean? It's not in the original, it's supplied. Well, now, all the original has is corners, which is mentioned in chapter 9, verse 26, about ran the corners of their beard. It's quite possible it goes back to Leviticus 19:27. Hair was an unusual thing. It kept growing. Even when someone dies, their hair grows. Do you know that? So the ancients thought it was magical. So hair was used in magical divination. It was also to cut your hair certain ways and put it in the grave of your loved ones was a pagan mourning rite. Also, to cut your hair and leave a little tassel here, a little tassel there, was symbolic of worshiping a particular god. Have you ever seen the hair of Krishnas around lately at the Texas State Fair, the guys in the orange suits, those aren't University of Texas cheerleaders. Those are Hare Krishnas. And that's on a purpose why their hair is that way. So, now that's possible. That could be. But I really think that anybody here have a New English Bible? It translated this way. Those and all who roam the fringes of the desert. Now that is just as valid because that fits more the context of these desert tribes. And verse 24 seems to be a summary, and it says, all who dwell in the desert. I think New English Bible has a better translation. It could be cut the corner of their beards. Matter of fact, in the Near East, the way you tell a Muslim from a Jew is, Muslims trim their beards, Jews do not. So it may be a particular hair style, but probably it should be, New English Bible probably has a better deal. Okay, moving right along. And all the kings of Zimri. Now, do we know anything about Zimri? Do you have a parallel reference in your Bible? I hope you don't. If you do, you've got a strange Bible. We don't know nothing about this group. Zero. Now, let me just show what many people think. You see that? Keep your finger on Zimri in 25. Look down at Shishak in verse 26. You see that? The king of Shishak. We don't know what that means either. But it seems like, this is a word I just learned about. I wasn't familiar with this. Have you ever heard of the word A-T-B-A-C-H? I guess it's atbash, bash or back or something. It's a literary term. It means that if you spell a name, okay, say the name was B-O-B, and you wanted to code that name so that nobody would know who you're talking about. B is the second letter of the alphabet. So you'd go to the second letter in the back of the alphabet, and you'd take that one, and you'd find where O is, and you'd go from the other end and find that. And it's a backward spelling of a cryptic name. Now, if you do that to Zimri, you get the word Elam, E-L-A-M, which is one of the nations mentioned here. Matter of fact, next. That's why I don't know if that's true. If you do that with Shishak, guess what you get? Babylon. Now, I personally don't see why Jeremiah is coding these names. He's mentioned Babylon about 100 times through here. Why all of a sudden does he want to play Dick Tracy on them? You know, I don't understand that. I do think that probably that Shishak is a... You know how remember how I told you, oh, the Jews like to take someone's name and change the vowels and make it mean something different? Like Baal, meaning dung and that kind of thing. This can mean humiliation, bow down in humiliation. So I think probably that's a play on words. And I think Zimri is probably better just Zimri than it is going through all that to get Elam, which is mentioned next and seems to be a doubling. So that's a good example of the cleverness of interpreters that don't mean doodly twaddly. You know, all that didn't solve anything textually, did it? And so another intricacy of textual criticism that doesn't go anywhere. It's cute, but I don't think it solves nothing. Notice in verse 28, and the Lord mentions, if the nations won't drink, tell them, thus says the Lord, you shall drink. Now what that's saying is, everybody's going to give an account to God. Nations may not have known Him, may not have had the Ten Commandments, may not have had any witness, but nations are going to give an account to God. And then in verse 30 and following, God is pictured as a lion, as a great worker, as a lawyer. Boy, He's everything through here. As a shepherd. Notice it starts out. Does the Bible call Yahweh a lion very often? About 3 or 4 times. Could that be the background of Judah being a lion pulp and the Messiah being spoken of as a lion from the tribe of Judah? Possible. Possible. The idea about he will shout like those who tread the grapes. Now, you notice the grapes are in italics, but you don't tread olives, they'll hurt your feet. So it had to be grapes. The best place to see that is Isaiah 63, 1 through 6, where the battle hymn of the Republic came from. My eyes have seen the glory, the coming of the Lord. Now, what these guys did, can you imagine your life's work being getting up at 8 o'clock in the morning, going out and getting in a vat of cold, soggy grapes and jumping up and down all day? Besides, you really had strange colored feet, you know. That's where some of that cereal came from. So these people developed songs to sing, and they would have someone play a musical instrument or beat a beat or play a harp, and they would sing and dance and shout. Well, you can imagine it's much more fun to dance around a bunch of grapes just to step on them. So they would sing and dance all day long, sing these folk hymns and jump in the grapes. And the word came to be used for a battle cry, screaming, you know, hollering. So here is God singing while he stomps the grapes. And the grapes are, guess who? That's right, us. Well, anyway. Notice where it says, he's entering into judgment with all flesh. It's not just Israel. It's everybody's getting the axe through here. Verse 32, the Lord of hosts. And again, it means the captain of the armies of heaven. The shepherds in verse 34 are the political and religious leaders. In the last part of verse 34, you shall fall like a choice vessel. Does someone else have a different translation of that? RSV or anyone here? Last part of verse 34. Pleasant vessel. Anybody have choice rams? What translation? New American Standard? Oh, it's the older American Standard. Yeah. Well, there's a okay, RSV, that's the one I thought. So does New English Bible have it. It seems that choice rams fits better in all these animals. See the masters of the flock and the slaughter of the animal? Choice rams fits better than choice vessels. The Hebrew consonants are the same. It's the vowels that differ. So I really think that probably choice rams. I like RSV and New English Bible on that. Something just to show you how... You know, I like to follow the Masoretic Hebrew text. That's the text the Masoretic scholars, the 9th century Jews, put vowel points in. But sometimes it is atrocious in what it says. It's just corrupt. There's no way to get around it. Like in verse 38, next to the last line, mine has, because of the fierceness of the oppressing, and then sword in parenthesis. Now, they get that, and they don't tell you, they ought to. They just say the oppressor in my margin. But what they've done is changed the Masoretic text to the Septuagint and some of the other ancient versions. The word there in Hebrew is, because of the fierceness of the D-O-V-E. Now, you can make a dove mad, but really, you know, obviously this is whackoed some way. So they follow the... It seems like to me they ought to tell you that. And most of them don't. So the Septuagint may be a closer rendition to Jeremiah's words because it's shorter. It seems the more we learn of ancient Hebrew manuscripts, and since the founding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found many translations in Qumran community that are translated in Hebrew or Aramaic and follow the Septuagint instead of the Masoretic text, which leads us to believe there may be several variants that came up into Jesus' day. Questions or comments? Yes, Phil. Okay. Right. Okay. Phil, my only question would be, when would you start it and when would you close it? Now, I have no problem with the number being here. I have the historical problem of not knowing when to begin and when to stop. Well, of course, we know historically the first deportation was 605. Okay? So what is 605 from 538? 67. Is that right? Is that right? And then the last deportation was 586, where the major, the temple was destroyed. Okay? Well, that's, if you go from that point to 538, it's only 48 years. If you go from the temple to the temple, which was 516, it's 66 years. And, you know, I have no problem believing it's literal, but I just can't work it out in history. That's why I'm wondering what's what there. You think maybe it's sometime before they came the first time, maybe, or sometime after the edict where it was fulfilled, that kind of thing? Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I don't do is say it's a round number, and when you get 66, you got close enough to make it fulfilled. But I don't know, Phil. I really don't. Yes, Max. Yeah, Egyptian captivity is really tough. But this, we have Assyrian records here. There's no, I mean, this is pretty, 605 is pretty well locked in, because we got three cross dates here. We got the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. We got the what year of Jehoiakim. We got the fourth year of Jehoiakim. And then we got Jeremiah's 23 years and the 13th year of Josiah. Well, that, with that kind of thing, we can lock that first one in. No, that's true. But this is a lot more specific than that. We have dates here. Well, of course, the deal with Christ was just the guy who set that up blew it. It was his problem, not the dating that was available to him. He just missed the date on Herod the Great. I don't think there's any way we can doubt, with three variables here all coming together in 605, that we're talking about 605.
Well, what I'm trying to say is, how do we know we're talking about 605 and not 601 or something else?
Well, I want to agree with you that many things in the Bible we cannot date. I'll agree with that. But some things are just so specific that we can date them, because, as you know, the Jews kept... And today, I got a letter from a Jew the other day. It said 5,022 so-and-so, you know. They've been keeping it for a long time. And when those Assyrian records and that Jewish chronology and Greek and Roman dating all have the same event, I think we can pretty well lock some of these things down. But like Christ, it never says. There's no date at all anywhere about that birth narrative. It never says in the year of so-and-so. Now, it does have Herod the Great, and he died in 4 B.C., so it had to be before that. And how that guy, see, somebody just in the Middle Ages figured that back and changed the whole doobie. So, I agree that, like the New Testament books, we can't date for nothing. But Cyrus's edict, that's a biggie. So I think these dates would be sure. I think some wouldn't. Boy, that chronology of how long in Egypt, now that is a booger bear. And there are really some discrepancies, look like. And all I can say with that is wait for further information or something. But this one I think is pretty good. Yes, Donna? Well, what people say, and of course this is just, if you come to the text thinking it's a round number, you can justify it. If you come thinking it's a literal number, you can probably justify that too. They say it's the divine number 7 combined with the human number 10, which means God is going to complete His will in human life. You can make eggs and chickens and marbles out of that deal, can't you? So, I don't know. Yes, Coy?
Thank you.
Of course, that surprised me because many of the kings of Judah never lived a godly life, and their years are recorded. You know, many of the kings of Judah and Israel were really turkeys from day one, and their years. See, the Bible never gives dates. It never says, because there wasn't a calendar like we had. It just gives in the reign of. Or it says the Battle of Carmish. And so it dates it, but only by events in history, not in anybody's calendar. And we have to go back and compare calendars to get the dates. That would surprise me to find that to be true. Really would. Now, there is some chronology problems. A guy who tried to add up all the people's ages and go back and find when creation was, you know, 4004. The Bible does call grandchildren children and daddies and their great-granddaddies. Now, it does that all the time. It skips generations in mentioning descendants. That's why you can't go back and add the dates up.